Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into the latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I'm Dr. Mohsin Subbani, 28, Associate Editor with UEG Journal and a gastroenterologist based at Nottingham University Hospital, UK.
And I'm Maria Manuela-Espinho, also trainee editor of the UEG Journal and a gastroenterologist based in Porto, Portugal. Today we are back with the latest episode, and so let's grab a coffee and join us for a fast and focused roundup of what's new in GI.
Our first article today is titled Fatty Pancreas and Risk of Type 2 Diabetes, Chronic Kidney Disease and Cardiovascular Event. Study was conducted by Nicola Pugliese and colleague and was published in a recent issue in UEG Journal.
So fatty pancreas has gained increased attention as an ectopic fat depot linked to metabolic dysfunction. However, other previous studies have used inconsistent definitions, making it quite difficult to compare findings. This study is among the first to evaluate fatty pancreas using the new 2026 international consensus that uses MRI-based thresholds and examines its relationship with measured cardiometabolic outcomes.
Investigators analyzed over 19,000 participants of European ancestry from UK Biobank with imaging cohort. Pancreatic fat was quantified using MRI proton density fat fraction, or PDFF, and classified as normal mild fatty pancreas or moderate to severe fatty pancreas. Participants were followed up to a median 4.8 years to evaluate development of any cardiometabolic outcomes such as type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, or any cardiovascular events.
The strongest findings related to diabetes compared with participants with normal pancreatic fat, those with moderate to severe fatty pancreas had more than a threefold higher odds of prevalent type 2 diabetes and a 2.7-fold higher risk of developing diabetes during follow-up. And also, even mild fatty pancreas was associated with more than double the risk of type 2 diabetes. And importantly, every 5% increase in pancreatic fat was associated with a 70% increase in the risk of diabetes.
I must say, Manuela, this is alarming. So specifically for kidney outcomes, moderate to severe fatty pancreas was associated as high as 82% incident of chronic kidney disease, while each 5% increase in pancreatic fat increased the risk of chronic kidney disease by 11%.
The association with cardiovascular events was a bit more modest. However, both mild and moderate to severe fatty pancreas were associated with about 30% higher risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, although these findings were less consistent in sensitivity analysis than those that we have already talked about for diabetes and kidney disease.
Overall, the study suggests that fatty pancreas is not simply an incidental imaging finding. In fact, the newly established consensus MRI threshold, the authors demonstrate that pancreatic fat independently predicts future risk of type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and a weaker link association with cardiovascular events.
So, as a take-home message, I would say that these findings support incorporating fatty pancreas into the cardiovascular kidney metabolic framework and highlight its potential role in improving cardiometabolic risk assessments when abdominal MRI is already available.
Amazing. So, let's move on to our next study where we'll be discussing eosinophilic esophagitis and association between autoimmune thyroid disease, a population-based study by Suren Bozog and colleagues published in UEG Journal.
So, as you all know, eosinophilic esophagitis, or EOE, is a chronic immune-mediated disease of the esophagus, and previous studies have suggested that there may be a possible association between EOE and autoimmune thyroid disease. However, what we know is that the temporal relationship between these two diseases remains unclear. This nationwide Swedish study aimed to assess whether patients with EOE are at higher risk of developing autoimmune thyroid disease, or whether thyroid disease is already present before the diagnosis of EOE.
Indeed. So using nationwide ESPRESSO cohort, the investigators identified over 5,800 patients with biopsy-confirmed eosinophilic esophagitis diagnosed between 2006 to 2003, so it's a very robust cohort. Each patient was matched up with up to 5 population control cohort, and a sibling comparison was also performed to account for any shared genetics and environmental factors.
Yes, Mohsen. And the primary finding here was that EoE was not associated with a significantly higher risk of developing autoimmune thyroid disease. During follow-up, the hazard ratio was 1.18, which was not statistically significant. And also, similar findings were also observed after adjustment for multiple confounders and also in the sibling analysis that you have just referred.
However, on further exploration, you will find that patients with eosinophilic esophagitis were 29% more likely to have a diagnosis of autoimmune thyroid disease before their EoE was diagnosed, with an odds ratio of 1.29. More than 90% of these thyroid disorders were autoimmune hypothyroidism, including Hashimoto thyroiditis.
Yes, and also another interesting finding here was the age-specific effect. Children diagnosed with EoE had a much stronger association with autoimmune thyroid disease than adults. Childhood onset EoE was associated with more than a twofold higher risk of developing autoimmune thyroid diseases, having an hazard ratio of 2.5, and almost fivefold higher odds of having pre-existing autoimmune thyroid disease with an odds ratio of almost 5.
So interestingly, Manuela, taking these findings into account, authors suggest that this stronger association in children may reflect differences in immune activity, greater clinical surveillance, and a shared immune mechanism. Although observational design cannot establish causality, the finding highlight a distinct subgroup of patients who may warrant closer clinical attention.
Yes, so take-home messages here are that adults with EoE do not appear to have a substantially increased future risk of autoimmune thyroid disease. However, autoimmune thyroid disease is more common at the time of EoE diagnosis, particularly in patients with childhood onset EoE. So, as clinicians, we should remain alert to symptoms suggestive of thyroid dysfunction, especially in patients that are diagnosed with EoE at a younger age.
So let's move on to a very topical article, which we're going to discuss about GLP-1 analogs, which are quite a lot of debate ongoing. So in this specific study, the authors look into the risk of gallstones and bilirubin complication related to use of glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist for type 2 diabetes. The author included Mohammed Al-Dusuki and colleagues, and this was published in recent issue of UEG Journal.
Yes, as you have just alluded, GLP-1 receptor agonists have indeed transformed the management of patients with type 2 diabetes, but also obesity, with proved benefits in glycemic control, weight loss, and cardiovascular outcomes. However, there remain several concerns regarding the potential association with gallbladder and biliary diseases that have not yet been completely uncovered. So the aim of this real-world study was specifically to quantify those risks in our everyday routine clinical practice.
So authors actually looked into a database by name of TriNetX, which is US-based research network, investigated a big cohort of patients, included over 150,000 adults with type 2 diabetes. The cohorts were propensity score matched with over 400,000 patients receiving GLP-1 receptor agonist compared with equal number of matched controls receiving other glucose-lowering treatments, with follow-up extended to 3 years.
The main finding here was a modest but significant increase in gallbladder-related complications. At 3 years, GLP receptor agonist use was associated with a 43% higher risk of gallstones or common bile duct stones and a 45% higher risk of acute cholecystitis, and also a 54% higher likelihood of requiring cholecystectomy.
Yes, Manuela, but while looking into these findings, we should look into absolute event rates, and that remained very low. Only about 1.3% of GLP-1 users developed gallstones, and over 0.4% developed cholecystitis, and just 0.3% actually underwent for cholecystectomy over 3 years.
Yes, so perhaps the most reassuring finding was what the study did not show. GLP-1 receptor agonists were not associated with an increased risk of acute pancreatitis or the need for ERCP, addressing two important complications that have generated considerable concern in our clinical practice.
The risk also differed between individual agents. Semaglutide and dulaglutide were associated with significantly higher rates of gallstones and overall biliary complication, whereas liraglutide and exenatide didn't show any significant increase in the risk. The authors also identified obesity, steatotic liver disease, and alcohol use as an independent predictor of biliary event, suggesting that patient characteristics remain an important determinant of these conditions.
Yeah, so the take-home message here is that GLP-1 receptor agonists are effective, as we know, but they also have a quite favorable safety profile. However, as clinicians, we need to be aware of the modest increase in gallbladder disease, particularly in long-term treatments, and also in patients that have obesity or fatty liver disease. As clinicians, we need to be aware that if our patients develop persistent right upper quadrant pain, fever, or jaundice, of course, they need to be evaluated promptly for biliary complications.
Quite rightly. So, taking these findings into account, the appropriate use of GLP receptor agonists also warrant a right indication. Absolute risk of biliary complication is low. There was no increased risk of pancreatitis or ERCP for most patients, and a proven metabolic and cardiovascular benefit of these agents are likely outweigh the relatively small increase in risk of gallbladder disease.
Yeah, thank you, Mohsen. And now we move to our final article that explores a topic that is becoming increasingly relevant in our clinical practice, the impact of metabolic syndrome in patients with IBD.
So traditionally, we think patients with IBD as underweight or malnourished, but that's no longer the reality. Better disease control, changing lifestyle, rising obesity rates mean that metabolic disease is now an important part of IBD landscape.
So using the 3NETX electronic health record, the investigators analyzed nearly 1 million patients with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis between 2010 and 2024. The major finding of this study was a dramatic rise in cardiometabolic disease. For example, hypertension nearly tripled, diabetes more than tripled, obesity increased almost sixfold, and metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease increased almost tenfold.
As for Inc., the key question was whether metabolic syndrome simply coexists with IBD or whether it affects the outcome. Compared with patients who had IBD alone, those with metabolic syndrome had approximately double the risk of major cardiovascular events, heart failure, chronic kidney disease, and MASLD. They were also experienced high rates of hospitalization, corticosteroid use, and IBD-related surgery in patients with IBD and coexisting metabolic syndrome.
Yes, and that's very important because this suggests that metabolic syndrome may be more than just a comorbidity, as it may also be a marker of more severe disease presentations in patients with IBD. However, while this observational study cannot prove causality, as we all know, there are plausible biological mechanisms that help us to understand this more deeply. For example, we know that visceral adipose tissue promotes chronic inflammation through cytokines like TNF-alpha and interleukin-6, and these contribute to insulin resistance and also alter our gut microbiome. On the other hand, corticosteroids may further worsen metabolic dysfunction, and all this creates like a vicious cycle.
And importantly, these findings build on previous studies showing that 1 in 5 patients in IBD already has metabolic syndrome. What this study adds is that longitudinal perspective demonstrating that burden of metabolic disease is increasing and associated with poor clinical outcomes across multi-organ system.
And as with any real-world database studies, of course, we are dealing with some limitations. Diagnosis relies on electronic health record coding, metabolic syndrome was defined using diagnostic codes rather than formal criteria, and detailed information on disease activity, inflammatory markers, diet, and also, for example, body composition wasn't available. Nevertheless, the consistency of these findings, and also cross diseases, as we have already said, makes the overall message quite compelling.
So my take-home message is that modern IBD is no longer just a disease of intestinal inflammation. Metabolic has become an important determinant of patients' outcomes. Alongside controlling the inflammation, clinicians should actively assess and manage obesity, diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, and fatty liver disease. And a multidisciplinary approach might be warranted.
So this study doesn't prove that metabolic syndrome causes worse IBD, but it provides strong real-world evidence that patients that have both conditions, IBD and metabolic syndrome, experience substantially poorer outcomes. So as gastroenterologists, we increasingly need to treat the whole patient, not just the gut, and to pay attention to these very important comorbidities and factors of disease activity.
So with this end, thank you very much for joining us for the latest episode of UEG Journal Podcast. Today's studies reminded us that gastroenterology is increasingly connected with broad aspect of health, from metabolism and immunity to long-term patient outcome. We hope you enjoyed this quick review of latest research from UEG Journal, and I hope that you will join us with further episodes. Up till then, please stay tuned and don't forget to subscribe and share UEG Podcast. Thank you.
Yes, and if that's the case, we would like to say to you that happy holidays to you all. And in case you have already had them, well, enjoy your return to your work. Bye.